Good afternoon. It is one bell of the afternoon watch. And this is Captain Joe from the captain's chair. And we're not doing it with music this afternoon because we're not doing it with music this afternoon. I'm my own engineer. And since I'm a simple sailor who can barely read or write, I've not yet completely mastered the whole board here. But I do have to have make one comment about the program that you just heard a piece of, or maybe you heard all of it. And that is that it's always a pleasure for me to come in a little bit early and to listen to Real Talk with Susan on Voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band and streamed by voiceofvashon.org. And that she had a guest this today that brought up some points that about which I particularly wanted to ask some questions. But it's Susan's program, not the captain's program, and therefore I did not get to do that. But sometime I will be around in the same place where Martin's close aboard, and I will ask him those questions. They have to do with Soviet music as against Soviet scientists, because I've had quite a bit of contact with Soviet scientists during the Cold War period in the Antarctic, and I found the openness there to be quite different from what I encountered with Soviet fishermen up on the Grand Banks of off of Nova Scotia, for example. So, Martin, I know you're still here. I looked at your book. It's absolutely lovely, and I am here endorsing your presence at the O-Space this coming weekend. And may you sell 1 million copies of that book. The Smithsonian Institution will be delighted. So this afternoon, I don't have guests here. I have friends who come in, and we sit and talk. And my friend today is Bill West, and Bill is a friend on several fronts, but I'm going to uncharacteristically turn the mic over to somebody else, and Bill, ask you to give us a short but pithy biography. So let's get back to Bill, who has a very interesting story on several fronts, but now we've got the mic properly working. See, in my service life, I always had ETs, electronic technicians, or TTs, telephone technicians, or all sorts of people in my ship's company who would make those repairs for me immediately. And therefore, I never learned some of the most simple electronic connections. So over to you, Bill.
Well, in my maritime career, as a fisheries biologist, we usually did not have electronic technicians or technicians of any kind other than what we were able to learn ourselves. So I was grateful that Susan was able to step up on that, and we didn't have to listen to a bunch of dead air while Captain Joe and I struggled. Anyway, let's see. I was born in the South. Captain Joe asked for a brief but pithy bio, so I'll give it to you. Born in the South, moved around a lot as I was growing up and going to public school. Came out to Seattle to attend the University of Washington, majoring in biological oceanography in 1969. Learned that biological oceanography is actually about microscopic things that I did not find very interesting, so I fiddled around for several years, dropped out of school for a while, did construction work, then realized that fisheries was going to be my my passion. And that was based on my desire to emulate Jacques Cousteau, whose movies had formed a great deal of my worldview and the world of my imagination. And specifically, I was looking forward to the day when someone would say, "And now Guillaume will put on his skimpiest bathing suit and leap into the water."
I was just about to say that.
Yeah. And the bad news that I learned as a fisheries student is that The major fishery resources of the world are located at high latitudes, either close to Antarctica or close to the Arctic Circle, with some exceptions here and there. But generally speaking, fish like it in places that people don't really want to swim in skimpy bathing suits, which is a loss for the world. But
Indeed, it is.
Nonetheless, I went on to have a very enjoyable career for 25 years. It took me all over the world. I specialized in the design and performance of commercial fishing gear, with the goal towards making commercial fishing operations more efficient and sustainable in terms of harvesting what is okay to harvest and needs to be harvested and is intended to be harvested, and letting the little things and the unwanted things and the things that need to grow some more get away unharmed. And in the meantime, not burn up any more fuel or tear up any more seabed than necessary. And that, I got a great deal of joy out of that for many years. And during part of that time, I lived and worked in Norway at the Institute for Marine Research, or the Havforskningsinstitutt, and along the way learned a little Norwegian and learned a lot about Norwegian culture and learned a lot about fishing operations, and I hope I left a few marks of my own there. So after that, when I came back to the States from Norway, it was a great place for me professionally, but was not good for my family situation. And so I left and came back to the States and tried to re-enter the world of fisheries research in the United States. Unfortunately, that's like going, if you've worked with Norwegian fisheries researchers and you come back to work in the U.S. with comparable people, that's kind of like going from the A team to F troop. And that wasn't satisfying. So I decided I needed to do something entirely different. And for reasons that I have never yet quite figured out, I went to law school and became an attorney for 10 years, practicing admiralty and maritime law, as well as natural resources and environmental law. And so that was a way to put some of those tools from the toolbox to use before they got completely rusty and useless. And that was satisfying for a time, but now I like to say that I am several years into what appears to be a successful program of recovering from attorneyism.
So you've given me a couple of leads here, Bill, that I'm going to pick up on. And one of the connections that you and I have is that you have gone to sea with Coast Guard vessels that were engaged in fisheries research. And although you and I never sailed together, I often had fisheries scientists from the National Marine Fisheries Service who sail with me, but I think that most of your experience was in the Pacific side. Is that not true?
Yes, most of it was on the Pacific side and points north up into the Bering Sea and beyond. Some work in the North Sea and the Barents Sea, and some work in the Gulf of Mexico and some work in the Bay of Bengal. But I did not do, other than that work off of northwestern Europe, I did not work in the Atlantic very much at all. I did spend an awful lot of time at sea, certainly not as much as a serving crewman or officer on a Coast Guard cutter, add it all up and it came out to several months out of each year and at all times of year. Unfortunately, fish refuse to be easily captured when the weather's nice. And so I was out there in all of it.
So one of my, in my first command at sea, I was the captain of a small Coast Guard patrol vessel out of San Diego, which was then and probably still is the home port of the tuna fishery. And it was right at the time that the tuna fishery was converting over from handline fishing to the power block out on the end of the boom and the polypropylene nets. And you could always tell when you were meeting one of the old hands that whether or not he had sailed in the fishery when it was done by handline with those enormous gang hooks, because in the middle of their chest, they always had a great big scar, which is where they had been caught by one of those big gang hooks. I was not nearly as experienced then as I came to be much later on in the whole business of fisheries enforcement to have understood the complexity of such things as the change in the method of fishing and what effect that would have on, in particular, the yellowfin tuna fishery. So since you have a lot more experience than I in the science of it all, because you are basically a scientist and I'm just that simple sailor who can barely read or write, that what your observation is, and in particular comment on something that seems to me to have been true of fishing since the beginning of time, and that the stocks will always come back. No matter how much we overfish, the stocks will always come back if we leave them alone for a little while. So I'd like your comment on that from a scientific point of view.
In a way is true. Nearly any environmental ill that you can point to, if anyone asks my view on how we can recover, I usually say something along the lines of 7 billion glasses of Jonestown Kool-Aid in a couple thousand years, and it'll be right as rain. It is possible to fish a resource, and you know, and then I'm going to speak specifically about fisheries, but it's also true of forestry or any other natural resource management situation. It is possible to fish a population or a resource down to the point where changes occur in the ecosystem and in the biological structure of that resource that are very, very hard to recover from. It's like you've changed the paradigm. You've gone from water to ice, and it's still water, but it doesn't work the same way anymore. So, yes, with enough patience, most of the famous resources that we miss now, or maybe we don't even know we miss them, because they've been gone for a while, but eventually I believe that they would come back as long as the fundamentals of the ecosystem have not changed in the meantime. And that was our task as fisheries biologists, was try to figure out how much fishing pressure, how much economic exploitation, how much exploitation for fun, for recreation, how much could be harvested without causing those kinds of changes in the ecosystem or in the structure of the population that we were fishing on, so that practical and enjoyable use could be made. There's an awful lot to say, but it would start sounding similar. So
the consensus seems to me that if we leave a fishery alone for long enough, and that there is a basic stock left to build on, that it will come back. My experience with the tuna fishermen in San Diego, and not only was I part of the enforcement effort, but I was even a greater part of the search and rescue effort, that sometimes they would take those big tuna clippers out of San Diego and run right close to the edge so far as the fuel was concerned. And then, by golly, mayday, 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 I need a pull home. So I've come back into the port of San Diego with a boat about half again as large as I was out on the end of the towing hawser. But my experience with them was that they almost all of them believed that no matter how much more fish they would take with each haul back, with the big nets that were now being used and the power block that out on the end of the boom that could pick the nets up and then drop them on the deck, and an enormous number of tuna would dump out on the deck, in less than a generation of fishermen, the whole fishery changed so dramatically, and it went from, I don't know what the order of magnitude would be, but an enormous difference in the number of fish that could be taken with each haulback. And that even so, they were very resistant to any kind of fisheries management especially fisheries management by the federal government, and yet those are all federal fish because they're fishing out in international waters. Anyway, it was a very interesting time in my life, and it set the stage for the next time that I had anything to do with fisheries, and that was with the, in particular, the Russian fleets up on the Grand Banks. And the ship that I was the captain of at that time was one of her missions was to go up and to enforce the various international laws and treaties that had to do with the fisheries, the international fisheries up off the Grand Banks. So my question to you here is what, if any, contacts you ever had with the Russians? Because in particular, the Russians were, from my side of the ocean, were particularly challenging.
Yes, actually, I had a brief but very intensive interaction with Russians. I was, as a fisheries student, my summer job one summer was to go out aboard some, at that time, Soviet-flagged factory trawlers operating off the coast of Washington, Oregon, and California in the hake fishery. And this was back before the fall of the Soviet Union. We were definitely in one of the chillier parts of the late Cold War. I spent 2 months out there. I was I operated on three ships at various times, rotating from one to another to another. I was taken out by a Coast Guard cutter and dropped off with my two or three boxes of sampling gear and my duffel bag full of clothes, and given a metaphorical pat on the fanny and told to stay safe and do good things and have a good time. And actually, I had a ball, and it was not because the Russians were necessarily always easy to deal with. There were some fairly hard-nosed officers on these factory trawlers who had very demanding production quotas to meet, and they were going to meet them even if they had to, starting with lying, cheating, and stealing, and fishing illegally, and going all the way up to falsifying the records. But so they were very driven to do what they were supposed to do. Kind of like fishermen are always driven to catch more. That seems to be part of the game. So I did butt heads with some of them. There was a couple of the officers didn't want me to set up my sampling station down in the fish processing area, which is where actually I had to be in order to observe what was coming aboard, because that was the first place where I could get access to the fish. I could not do my sampling work out on deck where the catches were being dumped, because I would have gotten washed overboard and would not have had a very enjoyable or lengthy trip.
You wouldn't have been here with me.
Indeed. And although the factory was exciting enough, there were uninsulated power cables everywhere and saws for cutting up the fish that were had no guards on them, and the pulleys that drove the saws flying around everywhere, steam lines that could and did sometimes just randomly blow, and but it was better than being on deck. I had to work things out with the officers to get the permission to do the work that I was out there to do. Some of the other observers that went out at the same time I did, we were the first group, by the way, to ever go aboard Soviet ships. And while there had been observers out on other ships of other nations, Japanese, West Germans, East Germans, Poles, had observers had been out with those people for two or three or four years before we went out with the Russians. It was a whole new ball game. It was a new culture. It was a new way of operating, new attitude. Now, personally, you know, and indeed with some of these officers that I butted heads with, we became great friends and really had a blast. I found them to be very open. I was embarrassed to discover that they actually knew more about American history and American culture and American society and American sociology than I did about their own backgrounds. Now, a lot of it was pretty slanted, but they had a better fact base to work from about American life and American history than I did about Russian life. And I'd put some effort into trying to educate myself before I went out there. So had a great time, did what I thought was a good job. Was really glad to get back to land. Couldn't stand up straight for the first few days after I got back on land, and I had to lose my sea legs. And it took me another month or so before I was speaking normal conversational idiomatic English.
So here's my story about contact with Russians. I had the way that we checked the hull back was to put the bow of the cutter as close up into the ramp as we could safely get and still get and still back out of it. And so at one of these haulbacks, I decided to go over and make my number with the factory ship captain, who had, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 boats that were reporting to him to bring their catch. And he, so I sent a signal captain on the captain-to-captain circuit, and I said that I was coming over myself, and that this was as much a social call as it was an enforcement call, and that I trusted my enforcement people to do the inspection that was required by treaty and by the law. And so I went up to the captain's cabin and was not only greeted by the captain himself, but also by the fishmaster, to whom you had just referred, and also the political officer, who was also part of this party. And right in the middle of the table were several bottles of, I suppose, mid-grade vodka. I suppose that if I'd been an enthusiastic participant, that they would have broken out the better stuff. But I suspect that maybe this was mid-grade, not, yeah. And so I said, Captain, I appreciate your hospitality, but I do not ever drink at sea. And those who are friends of long standing on this program know that at one point in my life, I was an enthusiastic participant in that particular activity, but always ashore and never at sea. And I never broke that rule, and I wasn't about to do it for the Russians. Well, the Russian captain took great umbrage at this, and he implied that if I did not begin the toasting, that I was indeed causing an international incident from which the two great nations would never, ever survive, much less recover. So we had this discussion at some length, and I finally said, Captain, let's be clear here as to who is the enforcer and who is the person who is being enforced upon. And I am the enforcer, and if we could send a signal, I'll have my gig come alongside and pick me up and take me back to my cutter. And so we parted on that note, my not having caved in to drinking and the Russian not having caved in on trying to get me to drink. And we then continued for the rest of the patrol. We were on that station for another 6 weeks, and we saw these ships working, and we continued our enforcement efforts, but never once again was I invited to that ship to come over and have a drink. So at my birthday party, Bill, you gave a wonderful Norwegian toast. And I'm going to ask you now, as part of our closing ceremonies, and we do have closing ceremonies on this program, ask you now if you would give that toast for all of the people who are in particular of Nordic extraction, and that's not just Norway, but all of the Scandinavian countries. And I know that there are a lot of you, a lot of you out there. And so Bill is going to sing this wonderful toast that he gave to me at my birthday party not too long ago. So carry on there, counselor.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you a little backstory. This is one of the pieces of Norwegian culture that I picked up. I learned this song at and over the course of many parties with my colleagues from the Fish Capture Division of the Institute of Marine Research. And it was sung at pretty much every party because its point, its purpose, its reason for being is to celebrate an individual, the person being honored. So birthday or got their doctorate or won a lotto ticket or, you know, crossed the street without getting their shoes muddy, you know, anything. But and it's an old song, I was told, that comes from the Viking days, and I don't know how true that is, but I like it, so I say it, I repeat it. But anyway, I'll sing you the song now. It's quite a simple song. Oh, detta skall vara till kapten sin skål, hurra! Oh, detta skall vara till kapten sin skål, hurra! Och skam till dem som ika kapten sin skål vill dricka. Den skål var bra, hurra. And then skål.
Oh,
and you
the
raise
skull
your
part.
Glass.
Yes.
And really what it's saying is this is a toast. You insert the name of the honored person. I said kapten because that's a lot easier than saying Captain Joe or Kapten Yo or, you know. You insert the name of the person. This is a skull to the captain. This is a skull to the captain. This is a good toast. Anybody that doesn't want to drink this toast should be ashamed. And my friends told me that from the Viking days that to tell someone publicly that they should be ashamed was more or less the same as saying, has anybody seen where I left my axe?
All right. Well, on that high note, Counselor, I am so grateful for your time together and for our time together here, but even more so because one of the things that you do as your way of giving back to the island life is that you are a school bus driver here on the island. And involved in many, many other things and good for the island community. So I'm going to close with quick public service announcements. The Scouts will have their tree sale on the 7th and 8th of December behind U.S. Bank. And for more details on that, get in touch with Colton, who is one of those who mans the desk at Chase Bank, used to be Chase Manhattan. I was a Chase Manhattan customer once when I was stationed in New York. Today is Giving Tuesday. And if you don't have any place in particular that you think you'd like to make a donation, I am certain that the Voice of Vashon would be always willing to accept. But pick out your favorite and send them a contribution of the amount that fits whatever you want to give and a little short note saying thanks to whatever that group is that and whatever they do for your particular place in the community in which you live. This weekend is Christmas music, and it's being put on by Allison and Pete of Vashon Events. And so there's a lot going on this weekend. Also out at Point Robinson on Sunday will be our open house from noon until 4 o'clock. And among many other things that are going to happen, the Lighthouse Santa will be appearing. And he will be there at about 1 o'clock or 1300 in the afternoon. So we have come to the end of our time together, and as is my custom, I'm going to change the custom just a little bit. I woke up this morning pretty much athwart ships with the world, and I was even tempted to not heed the reveille call from the bosun's mate of the watch, and who is my cat sailor. And was just going to roll over and say I was going to give it up for the day. And then I went on to the Coast Guard channel. And then I looked around and figuratively I saw the flag that a friend has given to me a few years ago that says, don't give up the ship. And I realized that not only was I not going to give up the ship, but I have no right to give up the ship. That there are people and things and events and places to which I have made a commitment, and I do not have the right to not live up to that commitment. So I rolled out, Got hold of the walker. I'm pushing a walker around. I'm doing this as in as little public view as is possible. And with all of that, I now say that we come to the end of our time together this afternoon. We meet again here at the magical hour of one bell of the afternoon watch. Watch out for each other. Be careful. Watch out for the children. It is dark in the morning and dark in the evening, and Bill will be out there driving that school bus. So everybody watch out. Take care of each other, and we will meet again. Take care.